Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. As we approach California's June 7th election, we'll talk in a little bit with Eric Early, Republican candidate for Attorney General. But we begin with this extraordinary book that's one of the bestsellers in America called This Will Not Pass. It's by two of the New York Times top political reporters, Alexander Burns and Jonathan Martin. And they write about the end of the Trump administration, the beginning of the Biden administration. You probably heard about their book with those tapes of Kevin McCarthy from the days after January 6th that went super viral. But there's so much more in this book. It is, I read it, it's one of my favorites of the year. They get into President Trump's relationships with different people, a lot of California connections, his relationship with Gavin Newsom, what really happened behind the scenes with Mitch McConnell, what happened between Karen Bass and Kamala Harris, which was not particularly great, what happened with Nancy Pelosi and Javier Becerra, which was not particularly great, the complicated relationship between Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Why has Joe Biden not been more successful as president? All of that is a deep dive in this richly reported book. And so this week, the two authors came into our studio, to our brand new set for TV, and we got a chance to talk to them. Here's a conversation that includes a lot of content we weren't able to fit in TV. They are just fascinating to listen to. Our guests for this week, the authors of This Will Not Pass.
Broadcasting across California, California's only statewide political show. You're watching The Issue Is.
And welcome to a brand new era of The Issue Is. Check out our beautiful new home. We are honored to have with us the co-authors of the buzziest book in all of politics this year. Let's put it up on the screen. We are talking about This Will Not Pass. It's by Alexander Burns and Jonathan Martin of the New York Times. Jonathan and Alexander, welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time. Great to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
So a lot in this book has made news. Probably the thing that has made the most news, though, is your conversation with Kevin McCarthy. You obtained these tapes, of course, the minority leader from Bakersfield, from the days after January 6th. This is what he told his leadership team privately about President Trump.
That would be my recommendation. You should resign. What he did is unacceptable. I've had it with this guy.
So McCarthy says that he actually never made the call to President Trump that he should resign. But it's remarkable the difference between what is said privately and what is said publicly, Jonathan.
No, I think you've really captured it, that Kevin McCarthy in the hours and days after January 6th was facing a profound political crisis. He was desperately worried that his party was going to be basically dragged down by President Trump. And he was also concerned that there could be more political violence potentially incited by his own members in the days after January 6th. And so what you hear on that tape is Kevin McCarthy grappling with not what do we do about Donald Trump in the future and should we be the party of Trump or not. It's actually how quickly can we get Trump out of office? Can we get him either to resign or impeach him before January 20th? Because he presents that much of a threat to the country.
And even more mad than Kevin McCarthy was Mitch McConnell.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a tough competition for who is angrier in the moment. But I think starting from the loss of the Senate majority in Georgia, in those two runoff elections on January 5th, stretching through the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and then the days afterwards. Both men are quite candid in private, and Mitch McConnell perhaps a little bit less private because he shared some of these comments with Jonathan directly, with just how far he believed Trump had gone. And, you know, our reporting is that a couple days after the riot, in our book, we describe how McConnell met with some advisors back home in Kentucky and told them, you know, if this isn't impeachable, I don't know what is, and that the Democrats are going to take care of the son of a bitch for us.
Yeah, and you had this extraordinary day on January 6th. You're embedded with the senators
right
as they're taken to this undisclosed location, and you get to talk to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, I spent most of the day of January 6th evacuated with the entire U.S. Senate, and late that night, after the Senate had reconvened to ratify the vote, McConnell is leaving the Capitol, and he sees me and sort of flags me aside and sort of asks me what I'm hearing about the 25th Amendment, which, of course, is the provision to sort of take a president out of office, which gives you a sense as to his mindset in that moment. And I asked him, I said, well, how are you feeling? I was doing my sort of Barbara Walters impression here. And I asked McConnell how you're feeling. And what was so striking is that he said he was exhilarated. And the reason was because he thought that Trump had finally gone too far. As he put it, he put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. He's discredited himself. And McConnell thinks to himself, the Trump nightmare that I have lived is over. I got my justices on the court from him, got my tax cut from him, and now we can move on as a party. And the Trump era has come to an end. We can wash our hands of it and how wrong he was.
And, of course, Mitch McConnell, known for showing his feelings in a big way.
Famously.
I think he's got a half smile that says that he's exhilarated.
Right.
And then let's talk more about Kevin McCarthy, right? So then a few days after that, we have this picture that comes out at Mar-a-Lago. And we see Donald Trump and Kevin McCarthy together again. Looks like all is well.
Right.
And we get the sense there that McCarthy is back on the Trump train, still on the Trump train. And even after these tapes came out, Kevin McCarthy still loyal to Trump, and President Trump still seems to be loyal to Kevin McCarthy, or at least not upset at him.
Well, loyalty is always a complicated dynamic
right.
with former President Trump. But right, it's extraordinary when you hear what Kevin McCarthy said in those days immediately after January 6th, and then you realize that photo was taken before the end of the same month. You're not talking about, you know, after the seasons have turned and tempers have cooled. It's a couple weeks. It's while the impeachment process is still going on. What Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans were confronting in that moment was a real searing test of whether they were going to be leaders of principle who were going to try to talk to their own voters and tell them the hard truths about what they all understood now about President Trump, or whether they were going to take the temperature of their political base and see, is there an appetite out there or not for breaking with Trump? And they did the latter, and they found that there wasn't a whole lot of appetite for walking away from Trump. And, you know, even at that point, Kevin McCarthy's, you know, the photo notwithstanding, he's not doing the full embrace just yet, because in private, he's coming back to Washington. He's saying to people somewhat apologetically, you know, I was already down in Florida fundraising. I was invited over. It would have been rude not to go. This sort of really not very convincing stuff, but trying to kind of be all things to all people. You know, as we're sitting here today, it's pretty obvious that he's made a more decisive choice.
That is clear. Now, one of the really fascinating things about this book is how many California players are at the center of it.
Yes.
Obviously, the Speaker of the House right now is Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco. Kevin McCarthy wants to be the next Speaker of the House from Bakersfield. Can you compare and contrast their leadership styles? Because from what you read, it seems like they're very different.
No, they are. And, you know, Pelosi is the ultimate inside player, somebody who is sort of very canny and sort of pragmatic, even though she's identified as sort of this traditional liberal, and somebody who I think sort of demands a level of competence and seriousness in government. And I will say this, we actually interviewed Speaker Pelosi and sort of asked her about her relationship with Kevin McCarthy, trying to, you know, prod her a little bit. And we said, don't you have something in common? You're both Californians. Don't you guys work together on state issues? And she gave us a look that if it could kill, we would not have left that office that day, because it was to say, of course I don't deal with him. Her contempt for McCarthy is so unmistakable. And I think McCarthy knows that and doesn't really try. You know, Kevin McCarthy is someone who's affable, who sort of likes the relationship elements of politics, but is not really driven by any core ideological agenda. And I just think Pelosi doesn't have much time or use for him at all.
And she also didn't have such great things to say privately, apparently, about Javier Becerra, who the Biden team was thinking about making the Secretary of Health and Human Services. He eventually got the job. Of course, he had been in Congress with her before, and she had a message to Team Biden.
She sure did, and she didn't get to deliver it before Biden made his choice. That, you know, she distrusted Javier Becerra going back to the first term of the Obama administration. She just thought that Becerra was on Team Becerra and couldn't be, couldn't be trusted to sort of play ball by Nancy Pelosi's rules. You know, fast forward a dozen years or so, or almost a dozen years, and there are a couple other people who served with Nancy Pelosi in Congress who would like to be a health secretary, including Michelle Lujan Grisham, the governor of New Mexico, a couple other folks who are eyeing the job. Biden, because he's under so much pressure to show diversity in his appointments and to do it fast, he sort of lunges at Becerra, not having sort of done the traditional base touching that you do, including with someone as prominent as the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. And after the appointment's been made, Nancy Pelosi reaches out to an advisor to Joe Biden and says, you know, don't you think you should have spoken to me first? I might have had some interesting information to share with you. And she doesn't say I would have stopped you from doing this, but I think the subtext was pretty clear.
And she may have given them that look that
you got
about Kevin McCarthy.
You can feel over the phone. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and another moment that was kind of juicy in terms of the California dynamics is Congresswoman Karen Bass.
Yeah.
Who now, of course, is running for mayor of Los Angeles,
right,
but at the time was being thought of as a potential vice presidential pick. Kamala Harris, who at the time was California senator,
right,
being thought of as a VP pick. And the behind-the-scenes dynamic, yeah, and that Harris may not have been all that nice towards Bass privately, at least her team.
Now, as you know from covering politics in California, it's a one-party state, so the fiercest rivalries are within the Democratic Party because they're personal, they're not political. And I think that certainly applies to Bass and Harris, whose politics aren't terribly different, mm-hmm, when you boil it down. But, you know, there's only so many slots, and there's a lot of people looking to get in those slots. And I think when it comes to Karen Bass, Kamala Harris and her advisors were surprised that Bass had this sudden surge, mm-hmm, in the early summer of 2020 as a potential VP contender, and they wanted to put a stop to that. And so there was some information circulating about Karen Bass that got into the public domain. And I think there was not a lot of mystery either from Bass's camp or from Biden's camp themselves that the Kamala Harris folks were sort of pushing that information about Karen Bass. And then you fast forward, Kamala Harris becomes vice president and is talking to Governor Newsom about the now vacant Senate seat.
Right.
And Gavin Newsom comes away from that conversation pretty sure that Kamala Harris does not want Karen Bass to replace her in the U.S. Senate.
Well, and the interesting thing is now is Kamala Harris's political consultants are working for Rick Caruso.
We noticed that, too.
It's funny how that kind of thing happens.
Who, of course, is running against Karen Bass in the mayor's
race.
And who
could stop Karen Bass from yet another post here?
There you go. And let's talk a little bit about Governor Newsom, because your book actually opens up with this story about Governor Newsom and President Trump and the fact that they had actually a decent relationship in terms of working together.
They did. Certainly in contrast to Governor Newsom's other Democratic colleagues and certainly in contrast to what you might expect based on where they come at things politically. But look, Governor Newsom is very direct in talking about his relationship with Donald Trump. That, look, he was a governor of a state dealing with a once-in-a-century public health and economic catastrophe. And what is he supposed to do besides find a way to deal with the president of the United States? So when Trump is calling him up and sort of saying different kinds of wild things, you know, he, like other governors, has to choose. Is he going to, you know, take it to Trump in private and public? Is he going to sort of escalate a political fight with the guy who controls, you know, the ventilators and the National Guard funding and other kinds of emergency resources? Or is he going to try to get along with this guy? I do think that Governor Newsom, somewhat more than other governors, because he has been around the block with Donald Trump in the past, I think had his number earlier than some other folks and made a very, very deliberate choice not to escalate a political conflict.
Yeah, you were chuckling at the body language between Governor Newsom and Trump in that video we were just looking at.
That was actually
in response to a question that I asked. Could this bring California closer? And then Trump pulled Newsom in.
And, you know, every minute of tape rolling, Trump knows that it's just torturing the heck out of Gavin Newsom, because Gavin Newsom does not want that camera running of he and a president who's despised by most Californians. And sort of Trump knows that and is sort of making sure that the cameras are on and we're shaking hands and we're even embracing, and you could just see Newsom's eyes there just thinking, what the hell am I having to endure here?
Yeah. When we interviewed Trump at Mar-a-Lago in April of 2021, we asked him, you know, were these Democratic governors who were saying such mean things about you in public, or were they nicer to you in private? You know, folks like Newsom and Andrew Cuomo, and he said, Gavin Newsom didn't say mean things about me in public. And he was right. That Newsom, yeah. Newsom was very, very,
very
deliberate
on that.
And the president noticed.
No, I think Governor Newsom is careful in his relationships with both parties. I mean, Kevin McCarthy or Donald Trump, I think he's been careful. Gavin has to keep those lines open.
Yeah, because the word is reciprocity that you guys refer to, and the idea of getting something back for that relationship. All right, well, up next, we're going to talk about the relationship between Barack Obama and Joe Biden. It's very different behind the scenes than it's usually reported. Plus, these two super reporters look at the future for both Democrats and Republicans. Stay with us. You're watching The Issue. As this is when you guys get to dance. We got Prince playing for you. Look at that head bob. That's what he does in the club, baby.
Vice President Biden, Vice President. That was a joke.
That was former President Barack Obama visiting current President Joe Biden in the White House for the first time. The new book, This Will Not Pass, details their complicated relationship. Here's a look at that book. We are back with co-authors Alexander Burns and Jonathan Martin. Okay, we know, especially when they were leaving, that they were advertised as this best friend, yes, super buddy cop thing going on, right? And what you guys point out is that it's more complicated than that, and there actually was some jealousy there.
Yeah. It's a political relationship. It was basically a sort of shotgun marriage forged in 2008 that served both parties quite well. But at the end of the Obama presidency, Joe Biden was stung because Obama and his inner circle nudged Biden away from seeking the presidency himself in 2016 and effectively anointed Hillary Clinton. Biden has never forgotten that. And so you fast forward to 2021, and Biden is now president in his own right, and he's off to a pretty good start. COVID appears to be fading. He's getting some major rescue bill passed to deal with the sort of impact of COVID. And Biden tells an advisor in the spring of 21, I don't think Barack would like quite at all the coverage of me as more transformative than him. And that tells you a lot about sort of Biden's perspective toward Obama. It's at best a sibling rivalry. But Obama himself's also jealous in this period and is also sort of thinking about Biden in not so flattering terms in this period, because Obama is hearing this chatter about Biden being a bigger figure. Is he the next FDR? You know, Biden's New Deal. And this is bothering Obama. And Obama tells people in private, the coverage is BS because they don't understand. When I was president 15 years ago, it was a very different Democratic Party. Why, we had a dozen Joe Manchins in the Senate. So there's sort of this long-distance sniping between Obama and Biden, the purported brothers
and
in
arms.
And you
quote Nancy Pelosi as saying that she thinks that Barack Obama was jealous of Joe Biden, at least for a moment. Let's talk a little bit about Joe Biden as a president, because you sort of paint the picture of the fact that he wasn't elected to necessarily be FDR, to be this transformative president. He was essentially elected to not be Donald Trump, but then he tries to be this transformative president. He loves this concept, and maybe that's when things start to go wrong for him.
Right. I mean, I think one of the major narrative threads of our book is that Biden starts out campaigning for president in 2019 on the idea that we need a president who is going to restore normalcy. We need to get rid of this sort of wild-eyed, aberrational figure in the White House, and, you know, then tinker around the edges of the way this country operates. You know, boost up the Affordable Care Act here, jack up the minimum wage over here, but, you know, we're not talking about, to borrow Elizabeth Warren's term, a big structural change. Then COVID strikes and demolishes the economy, sends everybody into lockdown for months at a time. Then George Floyd is murdered, and it's clear to Biden, to a lot of other Democrats, that, you know, a tinkering around the edges message doesn't really equal the moment. But he never really gives up on the normalcy message either. And so he barrels into the general election telling telling the country he's going to restore normalcy and heal the land, and telling the country at the same time he's going to transform it and make it a better and more just place in every respect. And you see him basically trying to ride two horses at the same time as he takes office and into the first year of his administration. He never really makes a decisive choice about whether he wants to govern as a conciliator or govern as a transformational president. And as a result, he ends up not quite doing either.
Yeah, and then not really accomplishing the big transformational change, like Build Back Better, because they didn't have the votes and didn't have the margins in the Senate or even the House. One of the big questions in Washington, which you guys are obsessed with, that most people don't necessarily talk about every day, is Joe Biden going to run again or not?
Right.
And if he does not, does Joe Biden think that Kamala Harris is the best person to succeed him?
You've just voiced what is on the mind of every Democrat in Washington and perhaps every state capital around America right now. No, this is the dominant chatter right now in the Democratic Party, because it's unclear if Joe Biden at age 80, which will be in November, is capable of running for a second four-year term. We just haven't been in this position before in recent American history, where you had a first-term president who was unclear if they were going to seek re-election. Look, Biden has told people in private, and we report in the book, he intends to run for re-election unless there's an intervening health issue. But as we also report in the book, there are grave doubts about Kamala Harris potential if Biden does not seek or cannot seek re-election. And I think it's pretty clear that if Biden doesn't run again, there's going to be a hotly contested primary, because Kamala Harris has, I think, a lot of doubters in the Democratic Party, same as she did here in California, and could have a really serious primary in 2024. And frankly, if the midterms really turn sour for Democrats this fall, it's possible that Joe Biden himself could face a challenge within his own party in 2024, especially if he does not make a decision in some kind of a rapid fashion about what his plans are.
Is the assumption in Washington that Donald Trump is running again?
Yeah, I think the assumption is that he is. I don't think people view it as an absolute certainty, but certainly presumed to be running until he absolutely isn't. And look, this is another issue that could keep the early stage of the 2024 campaign in a kind of suspended animation. If Joe Biden doesn't make up his mind quickly, if Donald Trump doesn't make up his mind quickly, you have these two guys, one just over 80, one pushing 80, sort of twiddling their thumbs and keeping everybody else frozen in place. It then becomes a challenge to everybody else in the Republican Party. Who's willing to get out there and make the case in spite of the fact that you could wind up on a debate stage with Donald Trump?
Right. And you guys say that if one of them runs, it makes the other one more likely to run, right?
Yes.
It's not just us. Joe Biden has said that in public, right?
Yeah.
If Trump runs, then he is more likely to run, too. And I think that there is this concern in both parties. You know, Republicans see every major political trend in the country, short-term political trend anyway, breaking their way. Inflation, gas prices, crime, et cetera. Democrats see Donald Trump as toxically unpopular. And there is this sense that, the only way the other guy wins is if we continue to blow it the way we're doing right now.
Isn't it crazy that back in 2007, Barack Obama wrote in Audacity of Hope, it's time to turn the page to a new generation in American leadership, and now we have turned the page back to the point that you have 80-year-olds potentially running for president.
And 2004 was supposed to be the last baby boomer election. Remember Kerry and Bush and how Vietnam was litigated? Here we are, potentially two decades later, you could have the same generation running again. And if you want to hear more about those two aging candidates for president, it's all in the book.
Yeah, the book is fantastic. It is the best book I've read this year on politics. Congratulations, Guy. Honored to have you here, and great to have you on our new set.
Thanks,
Jonathan Martin, Alexander Burns, congratulations. Our thanks to Alexander Burns, Jonathan Martin. Again, that book is really worth buying. Now to the race for California Attorney General. We have had on the Attorney General, Rob Bonta. We've also had on Anne-Marie Schubert, the independent former Republican, Sacramento County District Attorney who's running, Nathan Hochman, former the attorney from Los Angeles who's running. And this week we have on Eric Early, probably the most conservative of that crew, the most proudly pro-Trump, but somebody who is a real favorite among the Republican base in this state. And he joined us in studio as well. Here's Eric Early. We're joined by a candidate with a lot of support in the Republican base. Eric Early is here. Welcome to The Issue Is for the first time.
Alex, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk about that big issue of crime. It is issue number one. What specifically, tangibly, differently are you going to do if you're AG compared to Rob Bonta now?
A lot, night and day from Rob Bonta. I call Rob Bonta a criminal lover. Rob Bonta is a clone of George Gascon, okay? They have created what I call in California a criminal's paradise. I will do everything possible to lock up the prison cells again. I will do everything possible to set cash bail again. I will do everything possible to repeal this crazy law, Proposition 47, that lets you steal up to $9.50 at a shot, multiple times a day, by the way, and nothing happens to you. And I will support loudly and all the time our brave men and women of law enforcement. You know, these criminals, they may be criminals, but they're not stupid. We have to change the culture in this state. We have to let them know again that crime does not pay. Because right now, thanks to Bonta, thanks to Gascon, thanks to Newsom, crime unfortunately does pay in this state.
Rob Bonta, of course, had endorsed George Gascon in his race for L.A. County District Attorney. So how do you actually repeal Prop 47?
Well, you know, I was the lead lawyer for the recall of Newsom, the recall movement. And so I know the guys, Orrin Heatley and Mike Netter, know how to get these signatures, because what I would do is I would oversee a referendum. If you have an existing law, a referendum, if it passes, gets rid of the existing law. The people have to vote on the referendum. But it all starts with getting the signatures, getting the referendum on the ballot, and then I, as Attorney General, will be doing the ballot and title summary for that referendum, and I'm confident we could get it on the ballot, and when the other side comes on with millions of dollars try and lie to the people that somehow this Proposition 47 is good for the people, I will be there every day explaining why we got to get rid of it. I'm confident when I'm Attorney General, we will get rid of it once and for all.
Both Governor Newsom and Attorney General Bonta are making the point that abortion is now the definitive issue of this race. Do you think that Roe v. Wade should be overturned?
Well, I'm pro-life, so I support the way the Supreme Court is going. But, you know, as I tell everybody, Attorney General is not a legislator. We are here to enforce the laws as long as they're constitutional. So I have to enforce the laws in the state of California, whether I like them or not. But one thing I would say to these people in our California legislature and Newsom, et cetera, with everything they've been hinting at doing, they better make sure that whatever they're talking about is constitutional, because I'm not duty-bound to enforce an unconstitutional law.
Is there anything that they have proposed when it comes to abortion rights that you would say, I'm not going to enforce?
Frankly, I haven't listened to what they've been, any details about it. It's too premature. First of all, the decision in D.C. at the U.S. Supreme Court, it's not a decision, it's a draft. You know, careful attorneys, we don't redraft Supreme Court decisions. Frankly, I think it was a travesty that it was leaked. But first, I need to read the final ruling, see how it comes down. And then, as Attorney General, I have to see a final bill that the legislature and Newsom would come out with. And when I see that, then I could properly answer your question.
Let's talk for a moment about President Trump, which is something that they would bring up over and over again if you become the guy in the top two with presumably Rob Bonta. Mm-hmm. What's your take on President Trump? And what do you say to people that think that somebody who supports President Trump can't win in a state that voted against him by 30 points?
Well, first of all, my race for Attorney General is going amazing. And what we're telling everybody to do is vote early for early. The momentum is totally building in our favor, and we firmly believe we can end up in the top two on June 7th. But it's no secret, I support Donald Trump. I supported him when he was president. And what I could tell you, Alex, is that for the last year, I've been campaigning up and down the state. I've been speaking to thousands and thousands of people. And I know from them, and I believe there are millions of people in this state that support Donald Trump. And certainly for a position like mine, top law enforcement officer, top legal officer in the state, we want somebody tough, somebody like me, somebody who is not politically correct. You know, I'm the only one in the race who's never been on a government payroll. I run a very successful, nationally recognized law firm, and it's time for somebody like me to come out of the private sector and do what needs to be done to make every single California citizen of every race, creed, and color safe again. That's what I'm going to do. And President Trump certainly represents that to the people, whether they liked him or not. And, oh, by the way, we've seen what the other guy has done for the last 2 years. And I think it'd be hard-pressed for any Californian to say that their life is better off now than it was 2 years ago.
But you got to admit that President Trump lost the state twice by about 30 points.
Listen, I know that there are millions of people in the state support Trump. Even if you if you go by the voting numbers, he got at least 6 million votes in this state during the last election.
You've raised questions about mail-in ballots and whether they're constitutional. What do you mean by that?
Listen, I get this job, I'm going to do a deep dive into the entire election process in this state, from the universal mail-in ballots to this ballot harvesting, which, by the way, is illegal in most states in the country, to these computers. This is not just a Republican issue. We have people across the board, politically, across the racial spectrum, across the socioeconomic spectrum, who have questions with the votes. This universal mail-in balloting, our voter rolls are filled with thousands and thousands of people, either no longer live there, might have passed away, but they are mailing ballots to all these people, and constitutionally, that raises tremendous questions about whether this this process is even legal.
But is there any evidence of fraud? We had Larry Elder on the show right after the recall, and he said he asked people to send him evidence, and he wasn't able to find any evidence of fraud, and that was a universal mail-in ballot situation.
Well, let me tell you something. There were thousands of affidavits signed under oath by people who witnessed, experienced some form of voter fraud. Those never got to see the light of day, frankly, in court. Every single case was dropped on a technicality so early in the process. You know, I've litigated thousands of cases. Mm. There's reasons why cases take 2-3 years to litigate, because you have to go through the evidence. You have to bring in the witnesses who signed these documents. You have to, you know, examine them. We've never done that, and frankly, I've never seen any evidence from the other side that said there was no voter fraud. And what I would ask your viewers to possibly look at, see 2000 Mules, a new movie just came out. And before that, there was a movie that came out. It was produced by HBO when Donald Trump had won, and when so many people on the Democrat side were more than happy to talk about how he only won because of voter fraud. And this movie's called Kill Chain. Two words. You can find it on Amazon Prime. All kinds of, you know, respected Democrat senators speaking in it, and it's all about how easy it is to hack into these computer machines.
All right. On this show, we like to have a little bit of fun in getting to know you.
Okay.
So we do a game called Personal Issues. This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock, and we do some rapid-fire questions. All right, you ready?
Ready to have some fun?
Here we go. What is your favorite TV show?
My favorite TV show? Right now, my favorite TV show is Yellowstone.
Best thing about being a Californian?
This is paradise.
What's your favorite meal?
My favorite meal? Well, I like steak. Oh, I love pasta. So I think I'd go with pasta. Great pasta dish. I don't think you can beat it.
Who's your favorite Democrat?
My favorite Democrat? Let me think about that one.
Okay. What is your favorite song?
Well, you heard, we've told you, it's by Ian Hunter. It's called When I'm President. And I love it, not because I have aspirations to be president. It's melodically amazing. The words are amazing. And Ian Hunter is just a brilliant musician.
Well, you know, most politicians are try to hide the fact that they want to be president, but I love that you picked this song, and I know that doesn't necessarily mean that, but we're gonna end with your song of When I'm President, your chance to move on this show. Eric Early, thanks so much for being on.
Let me tell you the Democrat I like these days.
Yeah.
Joe Manchin.
Okay.
Frankly, I think in large part he saved this country.
Interesting. Mm. All right, we go out with When I'm President. Eric Early, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When I'm president, no more bodies in the basement. When I'm president.
Our thanks to Eric Early, and thanks to you for listening to the Issue Is podcast. We'll be back next week as we get even closer to that June 7th election, but you can vote right now. Ballots were mailed out to everybody in the state if you're a registered voter, or go out and register to vote. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.